Okay, so once again, we're back with the infamous podcasts with yours truly, the R&R Shrink. This is going to be, I think, the final podcast on addictions, which will complete our little series that I've done thus far. So if you haven't heard the first three podcasts on this, please go back and listen to those. They will make this listening to this much more intelligible. One thing I have continued to forget on the previous podcast is to mention another gentleman who I think the listeners ought to be familiar with, and that is Alan Marlatt. His work is really landmark in that, like myself, he's also an anti-12-stepper, an anti-disease model, and has literally hundreds of research articles and all sorts of book chapters and stuff written on the topic. He's an extremely erudite gentleman. Unfortunately, he is no longer existing on this plane as of about a year and a half ago, but his work is quite voluminous, and I highly recommend him to anyone who's interested in this field, along with the reference I mentioned earlier, the Herbert Fingerett book, Heavy Drinking, The Myth of Alcoholism as a Disease. So, what are you going to do when somebody walks into your office then? If you're not going to be a knee-jerk 12-step or disease model kind of guy or gal, what are you going to do? And one of the things I also mentioned is that most folks don't just have one issue. They come in and they're doing addictions because it's a cover-up, escape avoidance, or substitute for something they're missing, whether it's a full-blown disorder or self-esteem issues or whatever. Well, obviously, you've got to do a really good assessment because you can't assume that everything's due to the alcohol or drugs or whatever. In fact, I would say it's just the opposite. The substance use and abuse and dependency are all due to psychological or personal issues that people aren't dealing with. So you got to see what's underlying this kind of stuff. And typically, when folks come in, I do a very elongated intake interview. Now, this is true, by the way, if anybody walks in my office, gets the same two-hour intake interview, regardless of what their referral question is. And I do this because I'm compulsive, but in all seriousness, I also do it because I want to know what I'm dealing with. I make no assumptions that anyone knows what's going on with them, because even if they have history of being previously diagnosed, I find that a lot of these people are misdiagnosed or they're only partially diagnosed. And if they haven't seen anybody to get a quote-unquote real diagnosis, they just diagnose themselves because they're feeling sad and so they assume they have depression, or feeling stressed out, so they assume they have anxiety. You can't necessarily believe that, and it's not that folks will come in and intentionally lie, although certainly you do have those folks. The vast majority of folks don't really know what's going on with them. They have this sort of sense of how they feel, but they can't necessarily put a label on it. And honestly, it's not their job to do that. That's our job to do that as professionals. So I do a really, really, really thorough two-hour intake interview with a person. And if it's an adolescent, I do it with the family as well. So what I typically will do is do half the time with the identified adolescent patient, quote-unquote, and then half the time with the mom, dad, both, either, whatever, the primary caregiver or caregivers. And then really that's for me to get good historical data. It's not so I can tell tales out of school, so to speak. Every adolescent and minor person under the age of consent that comes to me gets privilege with me. And even though legally speaking, parents own or guardians own the confidentiality privilege, I give it to everybody that walks in the door because nobody's going to tell me dog squat if they think I'm going ratting them out to people. And I, of course, give them the typical standard disclaimer that if I really believe that they're going to go out and bomb somebody or kill themselves or abuse an elder or report, their serious intentions of sexually abusing somebody, or they report being sexually abused or whatever, obviously I'm required to report those kinds of things, and I make that very clear from the outset. But barring those kinds of stuff, I am very, very strict about adhering to confidentiality issues. And generally, if I think it's something that parents need to know, I'll convince the kid to talk to them about it in my presence, as well as giving me permission to talk about it. I don't like secrets and surprises, and I have to assume other folks do not as well. And I tell most parents, when they question me on this. I tell most parents, you know, my standard line, which is, you know, you wouldn't tell me dog squat if you thought I was going out ratting you out to other people either. You know, it's kind of like, you know, sometimes I use the analogy of, let's say that you have elderly parents who are living with their adult kids who are also helping to support them. And let's say the elderly parents are having issues, you know, let's say sexual issues, and they come in to see me. You know, even if their kids are paying for the session, they don't want their kids necessarily to know that, you know, dad can't get it up or whatever. You know, and I don't mean to be rude, but I like to shock folks with that kind of thing, because that sort of grounds them into some reality that just because they're parents and just because they're paying for it doesn't give them necessarily license, so to speak, to be privy to some of that stuff, because some of that, those kinds of issues are very embarrassing and or private to the folks that are experiencing them, just as parent sexual dysfunction would be embarrassing, I suspect, for their adult kids to know about. So I say, you know, you wouldn't want me, you know, calling your son and daughter up and going, hey, dad can't get it up anymore. You know, not a cool thing, right? Well, kids don't want me ratting on them either. So, you know, obviously if a kid's life's in danger or potentially in danger or health in danger or whatever, that's a different ballgame. But barring those kinds of things, I'm pretty close-mouthed about stuff, and I try to get the folks themselves to talk about it. So when I do the two-hour intake interview, if it's with a minor, I'll see the minor first and for an hour, and then while I'm talking with parents for the second hour, the minor's doing some self-administered testing for me, because everybody walks in my door also gets baseline testing, because as I tell everybody, you don't build a house without a floor plan, and you don't build a house on the side of a mountain or near a lake or whatever without doing a land survey, okay? And I'm not going to, you know, imagine myself some, you know, magical guru or God or Jesus or whatever who can lay on hands and go, okay, I'm getting psychic vibrations that you have depression. You know, oh, did I miss anxiety disorders too? Because I forget, you know, to do assessment stuff like most of my colleagues. Oops, did I say that? So it's really, 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 really important. I cannot stress this enough. And when I talk and do workshops to other professionals, I really, really hammer this point home. Do a thorough intake interview, because intake interviews and baseline assessments guide diagnosis, and diagnosis drives treatment. So you do a crappy diagnosis because you did a crappy assessment and a crappy intake, you're doing crappy treatment, and that's not a good thing. Okay? So I'm a firm believer in this, and if I have any reason to suspect that there are other things going on, I will sometimes refer folks to full battery testing, which is a full battery intellectual / cognitive thinking a battery of tests, and then a full battery of emotional, personality, social, interpersonal stuff, because I want to know what's going on. Because obviously, and I talk about it being head stuff and heart stuff, even though obviously it's all going on in your head, I sort of artificially dichotomize it that way so that folks can sort of get a handle on the emotional versus the cognitive. But that's really, really important. Certainly when I'm doing assessments, intake interviews and stuff, with folks, I'm wanting to get, and this is true for both addictions and non-addiction based referrals, I'm wanting to get, you know, historical data, medical stuff, any forensic history, any interactions with the court system, any previous counseling, you know, experiences, academic stuff or work, related stuff, any of that kind of stuff. If they're on medication, if they've been on medication, so what runs in their biological family, because some of these things certainly have a biological component. And all it does is it predisposes or makes them more likely, makes them more susceptible to develop things. There's certainly not a one-to-one correlation, and I sort of alluded to this when I talked about addictions having a genetic component, I think in the first podcast. And while, you know, clearly they do have a genetic component, there's no one-to-one correlation, because if that were the case, I would be an addict. And as most of you know who've heard the first couple of podcasts about me, is I don't do drugs, like, ever. Never been drunk, never been stoned, never tried any drugs. The only drugs I do, as I've said many, many times, are the theophylline and tea when I'm not drinking so-called, quote-unquote, decaffeinated tea. Tea doesn't really have caffeine. It has theophylline in it, which is a cousin of caffeine, but I usually drink de-theophylinated, or as most people call it, decaffeinated teas, decaffeinated coffees. Occasionally I'll do coffee with caffeine in it. On rare occasions I'll smoke a cigar. You know, I've done it a couple of times before at special dillies, like, you know, New Year's 2000 kind of thing. My band played a a gig and everybody was handing out these uber expensive cigars and, you know. But generally, I don't smoke. I'm allergic to cigarettes. I'm allergic to the chemicals they put in the tobacco, by the way, to make them burn, which is why I can tolerate pipes if people are smoking pipes or good cigars that don't have the chemicals that cause the additives, like the charcoal and stuff, to cause the tobacco to burn when you're not puffing on it, which is why that stuff goes out if you're not puffing on it, which is why cigarettes don't go out. At any rate, probably more information than most of you needed. So I don't do that. I drink on rare occasions, never been drunk, never have more than one or two drinks at one sip, usually one because I'm a cheap date and a lightweight. And if you don't drink much, as most of you know, that stuff really kicks you in the patooties. So I'm not a guy that does that. And part of the reason I do that is because I'm compulsive and a control freak and don't like to be out of control. But the other part of it is I'm a nerd, and let's be honest. And the other part of it is addictions run both sides of my family. So I'm not tempting fate. It's not something I need, so why am I doing it, right? So I'm not. Besides, the other reason is I've joked about it, but I'm serious as a heart attack when I say this. You know, if you're spending money on drugs, you don't have any money to spend on musical instruments. And I like my babies, as one of my fellow musician colleagues once described my guitar and bass and sitar and whatever collection, my babies, quote unquote. Can't buy nice babies and can't buy a boatload of them as I have if you do that. But at any rate, so I get a really good history on people, some genetic predispositions, substance use history, obviously, current and past, previous stuff, dating history, sometimes sexual history, depending on the situation. You have to be kind of careful about those kind of things. I will often ask about existential or spiritual orientations, religious orientations, and I try to be kind of gentle about that because I know that that's a very personal topic for me, and I don't. I assume everybody else is kind of personal about it. And if they're not, they'll tell me. Constellations within the family. Who, you know, what's the family made up? Is it a blended family? Do you have two people coming together from divorced, you know, previously divorced and remarried scenarios, what I like to jokingly refer to as the Brady Bunch syndrome. And unfortunately, they don't get along as well as the Brady Bunch usually, but that's another topic. You know, is it biological family? Is there conflict habituated stuff going on? Is it a pretty, you know, a rare case where everybody gets along and there's no history of whatever's in the family except normal stuff? You know, if the person's an adult and they're in a committed relationship or married or long-term, I ask about, you know, that kind of thing and what their functioning is like. I want to look at friends and significant others. Who do they hang out with? What's their peer group like? What's their extracurricular stuff? What do they do for fun, whether they're an adult or a kid? Because obviously adults do things for fun too, and if you don't, shame on you. As I said, I interview both the, when I'm working with minors, I interview both the minor and parents separately, but that way that if they want to tell me something and don't want to share it with the other person, the other person doesn't have to hear it, and you know that's kind of cool. Generally, I want to interview, if it's an athlete, I'm going to want to talk to coaches and or other team members if it's a really serious athlete. If it's a person who's involved with their church or synagogue or temple or some religious or existential group, I'm probably going to want to talk to their main person that's running the show there, particularly if they're very active in that. If it's an academic-related issue, I'm probably going to want to talk to teachers and relevant school personnel. Dating partners, if they're in a committed relationship for a really, really long time and the issue involves some sort of relationship, sexual, whatever. Certainly, if the person has a hospital history of any kind, medical or psychological, I'm going to want to get, you know, what went on and historical stuff. If they've had any sort of legal entanglements, I'm going to want to get any and all data regarding that. And if they're currently involved in a forensic scenario or court-related scenario, I'm going to want to see the paperwork and figure out what's going on. Typically, as I said, I do a two-hour intake and baseline testing, and the baseline test I use, which is considered the gold standard in my business, is what I refer to jokingly as the MMPI, MMPI, that stands for Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. And there's two versions. There's the MMPI 2, as I like to refer to it, the saga continues, which is an updated version of the old MMPI or MMPI 1. And then the MMPI A, which is specifically for adolescents 19 and younger. And generally, sort of the rule of thumb with that is if you've got more of an independent teenager, You give them an MMPI 2 if they're, you know, 18, 19 and they're not living in the house and they're, or they're emancipated or whatever. But if they're still in the house and involved with folks and they're 18 or 19, I'll typically give them the MMPI A. If I think that they require some sort of cognitive issue, so the referral is they're re-upping their ADHD stuff, or if I suspect they have attention deficits or learning disorders, I'm going to want to do cognitive testing, and there's a whole battery of cognitive tests, and I don't want to go through all that with the listener because I was probably just going to bore the bejesus out of you. Typically, I will sometimes do take-home questionnaires if it's a cognitive issue. I have a copy of the Barclay scales, which are really, really good sort of overview. They're intentionally used for initially for ADHD, but it really covers a lot more than just that. It's developmental issues on there and conduct issues and emotional stuff. It's just a really good tool. And for those of you who don't know, Russell Barclay is sort of the god of ADHD research. He's been doing it forever and a day, and I've been using his interview for a little interview thing for a long, long, long time. Really respect him and his work a lot. Always after I do the testing, whether it's just the MMPI and basic intake, once I score the testing, if it's that or if it's a whole battery, I sit down with folks and go over the stuff orally with them. I think that's really important for them to understand in common English what's going on with them. I don't pull any punches and I don't hide any things. I mean, if people are borderline personality disordered, I call them a borderline. I don't make nice. I don't use politically correct terms. And I describe what that means in real time and the challenges that faces. I really don't believe that folks ought to be lying about that or minimizing the stuff at all. I think too many folks in my business try to minimize and gloss over stuff, and I do not do that in any way, shape, or form. If it's an addictions issue, I will often give also some additional addiction stuff. The MAST, Michigan Alcohol Screening Test, is a good one if it's alcohol stuff. There's plenty of you know, those kind of things out there. I always say that the person who's doing the intake interview, the doctoral level clinician person or whoever is doing that, if they're certified or licensed in their state to do it, they ought to be doing the testing themselves. They should not farm it out to other third-party persons working in their practice. And I tell this to every person on the planet, although I'm only one of a very, very small percent that does this. I tell every one of these people, please don't be, you know, a lazy jerk and have somebody else do it, because I get just as much data from observing how the person approaches the tasks as I do from the actual scores, because for me it's two sets of data. So you get data from the actual scores, which are all, you know, standardized and normed against the person's age and sex, but you also get task approach behaviors. How does the person approach doing a hands-on, also known in my business as kinesthetic, a hands-on test versus a visual test, iconic, versus an auditory listening test, or when you're mixing, you know, two sensory data, visual and auditory, together, whether it's a long-term memory, short-term memory, what's the person's verbal expression like in tests where they have to verbally respond? All those are really good keys to tell me what's going on with them. And if I can't see those and make notes of those as I'm going, I have to rely on the person who's doing that. And frankly, I just don't trust anybody to be as compulsive as I am. And that's just being as honest as possible. If the person is going to require medication, I always refer them to a competent physician. And that means somebody who's going to want to look at my report that I write and not just hand medications out like candy like so many of these physicians do. And I'm not slamming physicians, but you guys know who've been to these folks, and that includes pediatricians or internal medicine folks or psychiatrists or family physicians or whatever. Oftentimes folks will go in and say, oh, well, I'm having XYZ behaviors, and they go, okay, try this. Well, it's not that they're being incompetent. That's how they're trained in med school. I call it the salad bar buffet approach. You know, what is the salad bar buffet items? What do they most look like? Oh, they must be lettuce. Okay, do you like green stuff? Try the lettuce and see if that happens. And I'm being a little flip about it, and I apologize for that for all you physician types out there. But, you know, let's be honest. This is not a real good idea, particularly with psychological issues, because it's unlike physical stuff that you can photograph or do an MRI or a CAT scan or a PET scan or an X-ray or tap you on the knee with a hammer and see how, you know, the Babinski reflex on the bottom of the feet or whatever. This is not something you can see or feel. you know, these are esoteric things in a sense, and you need some testing data to see what it is you're really dealing with. Because even if you get it right, let's say the patient comes in and says to you, hey, I'm feeling depressed, and you go, you know what, based on the symptoms you're telling me, you have major depression. Well, that's true, but what most folks don't understand is there are various types of depression that hit different types of brain sites, and that's not always obvious from the person's verbal report. But it is obvious if you do something like an MMPI, because the MMPI not only looks at trends of how you process data emotionally, but it talks about how you do those trends in your day-to-day life, and that gives us clues to what brain sites are involved, which gives us clues to what kind of depression you have, whether you have a serotonin-based depression or an epinephrine-based, a so-called, quote-unquote, atypical depression. That's uber important, because that tells you what kind of medications you want to give somebody, which is why you hear these cases of, oh, Paxil's a terrible drug, or oh, Zoloft's a terrible drug, or oh. No, they're not terrible drugs. They're used incorrectly, or they're prescribed when they're not needed because somebody did a misdiagnosis, which happens a whole lot more often than you guys think. If you've got somebody coming in who's got an addiction problem, they most likely, particularly if it's been existing for a long time, they've got a bunch of other stuff going on, and because of that, you're probably going to need a multimodal approach, which means you're going to need more than one person treating it. Now, in my case, I'm not only a psychology trained person, but I'm also an addictionology person. I have board certifications in addictions, and so I sort of wear a bunch of different hats, but I am not, you know, a registered dietitian or certified nutritionist or any of that kind of stuff. So if there's those kind of issues, like with eating disorders, or I'm wanting to get, you know, nutritional information, this person really needs, you know, a much more specific dietary stuff, I refer out. You know, if this person needs medication, I refer them to a competent physician. I am not a physician, you know, and most of these people who need drugs to handle their emotional, psychological conditions, it's pretty tricky. Particularly if they have multiple conditions, and particularly if they have to be on more than one drug. So it gets really kind of hairy sometimes, and I really like to send them to somebody who I know is going to do a really, really, really good job. If it's an adolescent who's still in school, or even an adult who's going to school, obviously I'm going to need to liaison. If it's an academic processing issue, I'm going to need to talk with them. If it's parole or probation officers, or legal officials, the court systems, or whatever, you know, it's going to involve a lot of different players, and typically you're going to involve significant others in that person's life. So you want to bring everybody in on board to try to help out, because, you know, none of us are God. We can't do this all ourselves. If you've got somebody who has multiple disorders on top of the substance use disorders, the SUDs as I call them, the SUDs, you're probably, particularly if you have something like ADHD or something like chronic, intractable, endogenous, inborn, so-called genetic depression, you know, you may need medication. And, you know, contrary to the old popular, you know, 12-step disease model, oh, if you're taking medications, you're relapsing. No, I'm sorry, friends, that's bullshit. If you've got ADHD and you're not on some kind of biochemical assistance, you're not going to become sober because you're going to use the drugs to medicate your ADHD away. That's ridiculous, okay? So there are certain things that are going to require medicational stuff. If you've got the person who has, let's say, trauma, they have post-traumatic stress disorder because they've been involved in some sort of so-called, quote-unquote, cult abuse, or it really should be called a negative spirituality, because let's be honest, friends and neighbors, a cult is whatever society says it is. In other words, a non-mainstream religion. And least we forget, you know, what was Christianity back in the day? That's right, it was a frickin' cult, okay? Romans considered it a cult. Everybody considered it a cult back in the day until it became mainstream religion. So all of you sanctimonious Christians out there, and that obviously, you know, includes people like me, although I'm not a sanctimonious Christian, at least I hope not, you know, you need to shut the heck up, because just because somebody isn't a Jesus freak doesn't mean they belong to a cult. You know, there's a lot of very, very, very valid esoteric religions and spiritual orientations out there that don't involve, quote-unquote, cult issues. But let's just say that you get somebody who's been involved in some sort of Jonestown-esque scenario, right? And they're used to groupthink and all this kind of stuff. You know, 12-step approaches to these people are going to be very traumatic. You're going to be re-traumatizing them. You need to get rid of that stuff. I personally have never, ever sent a single person to the 12 steps because I don't believe in them. I don't believe in the disease model. I think it's horse manure, and I've got plenty of evidence to talk about that. And so does Marlatt, who does a much better job at debunking it than I do, and so does Herbert Fingeret. So, again, I defer to those guys because they're a whole lot more erudite than I am. Now, that's what that means also is that a lot of times people will come into me who are already doing 12-step related work. And if for whatever reason it's keeping them afloat, they're getting something out of the social milieu, which is a good aspect of that. And I'm the first to tell you that. If you're using it as a social support system, which, by the way, is what it was originally intended, the 12 steps are not treatment. They were never devised for treatment. And I won't bore you with the history of the 12 steps, but it was never set up as a treatment model, period, end of story. Never, ever. It was a spiritual and social support system for people who wanted to become clean and sober. And if folks used it for that, and that only, I'd be totally in favor of it. Unfortunately, they do not. There's a long history of the disease model and 12-step adherence being very anti-professional and very anti-treatment because they thought they knew better and they were special and all this kind of stuff. And in my business, we call those narcissists. So don't even want to get me started on this one. So at any rate, I never send anybody to the 12 steps. And if somebody asks me what my view is, I'm very blunt about it. But I don't poo-poo it if somebody's already going to it and they're getting something out of it. And I try to teach them tools that they can use in addition to whatever they're learning or getting from those things. But obviously, if there's a conflict between what they're hearing me say and what they're hearing their 12-step members say, then I clarify it and I refer them to the research studies. And it's pretty freaking obvious who's right and who's not. And I hate to sound like a jerk, but I mean, that's reality, okay? So the other thing is if you're dealing with an adolescent, you really have to train parents how to deal with this, or even if you're dealing with people in significant relationships. If they're in long-term significant relationships, you have to work with those folks, and they often have to be taught how to interact and what to do. Education is a huge part of this, not only for the so-called identified patient, but for the folks that are interacting with them also. Very, 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 very important. Sometimes people will say, well, you know, what do you do? You know, when you get people that have, you know, 10 or 12 or 15 diagnoses, which is pretty common for my group, by the way, I'm sort of known as the guy that sees those folks. What do you start? What do you do? Well, you know, I try to do the most bang for the buck intervention, so to speak. And I don't mean that in the classical sense of, a typical intervention like addiction intervention. I don't believe in that crap either. But in terms of behavioral interventions, what I'm going to do, treatment interventions. I try to do things that are going to hit the most bang for the buck. So, you know, that would involve things like, you know, teaching them how to restruct and reconstruct the way that they process and think about information. It's going to impact a lot of different areas, not only depression and anxiety, but substance use and abuse and that sort of thing. You know, a lot of the characteristics of the folks that I see are very, very similar, and a lot of the issues are very, very common with the addictions folks I see. I mean, most of them have dependency versus autonomy issues. They don't, you know, they want to be independent, but yet they really want to be have somebody else kind of help them out. Most of the addicts have a high crossover with what's called ELOC, external locus of control. You know, why did you use? It's Monday, it's Tuesday. You know, I got the best sex from my wife or boyfriend I've ever had. I got the worst sex from my wife or boyfriend I've ever had. I got a job promotion. I got fired from my job. You know, it's Monday, it's Tuesday, it's raining, it's sunshiny, it's snowing. You know, any excuse outside of me, right? That's also very similar to conduct disordered folks and cluster B personality disordered folks and ADHD folks, which is why you see such a high comorbidity with those folks. Gee, I wonder why. Right. High impulsivity, immediate gratification stuff, just like with the ADHD stuff. Huge focus on self, whether it's full-blown narcissism or just being egocentric. And there's a big difference between those two, by the way, friends, and I won't spend a lot of time talking about it today, but people who are self-centered aren't necessarily narcissistic. Narcissists sort of are egocentric, self-centered on steroids. They do it to the point where it hurts other people. Most of the addictions folks have a very, very low tolerance for any kind of quote-unquote negative situations or emotions. So anything with deferred gratification, anger, frustration, you know, anxiety, angst, any of that kind of stuff. Most of the addictions folks that I see and substance abusing folks I see are pretty immature for their age, and that's a description, not a slam, guys and gals. So I don't slam people in my office. I don't like to be slammed, so I don't slam other people. That's just sort of my rule of thumb. Most of them are very high sensation seeking. You know, they like excitement. You know, if this is sounding kind of like ADHD, there's a really good reason for that, because there's a lot of crossover between these two disorders, which is why you see so many ADHD people using and abusing drugs. There's a lot of ambiguity and conflicts over and between expectations between self and family and peer group and society and all this kind of stuff. A lot of the folks I see come from broken, blended, single-parent, abusive, and or otherwise dysfunctional families. It's really, really, really common. They typically have a history of problems at work or at school. They often have adjustment issues as children or have had, and their relationships interpersonally, social interpersonal stuff is really kind of funky. As I mentioned, they often have coexisting comorbidity, or in my case and most of my folks, polymorbidity, which means they have a boatload of other disorders, usually cluster B personality disorders and or conduct or oppositional defiant disorder and or learning disorders and or attention deficits and or depression or mood disorders and or anxiety disorders, yada, yada, yada. They'll often have few to no appropriate, notice I said appropriate, role models, whether that be parents or peer group or whatever. You know, it's the misery loves company thing kind of thing. In addition, I see a lot of environmental reinforcers or encouragers for substance use and abuse, or at the very least, there's little to no reinforcement for other kinds of non-use behavior. Most of the addictions folks I work with have very little self-insight and very little insight into other people as well. They think they do, but they don't. They just don't. I'm sorry. They just don't. And that's also true of the ADHD folks. They just don't. I mean, they have very superficial, what I call superficial insight. They don't really have depth insight. Most of them have pretty low self-esteem, and you can understand why that is. And they also have very, very low self-efficacy. And I talked about efficacy in a previous podcast. So if you heard that podcast, you know what that term means. And those two kind of go hand in hand. Most addictions folks, like the ADHD people, have incredibly concrete, inflexible reasoning with usually large deficits in so-called executive functioning, fluid reasoning, abstract reasoning. Those are all the same kind of things. Higher level cognitive operations, they have a dearth of that. It's just really, really missing. And again, some of them think they have great insight and understand stuff, but they really don't. It's all superficial. There's only about, my understanding is there's only about 5 or 7% of the ADHD population that has that, and I definitely see that with the addictions people too. They're very concrete, touch it, feel it, here and now reasoners. They're not projectors into the future, what I call what-if thinkers. They just don't have any of that at all. They do a lot of distortions cognitively. Their thinking is distorted a lot. They adhere to the Elkind, who is a very famous person in our field, has this concept of personal fable, and they which means they believe their own stuff, basically, and they adhere to that. They are huge moralizers. They overgeneralize. They catastrophize. It's awful and terrible stuff. They use what I call emotional reasoning as opposed to rational reasoning. So they believe it's true because they feel it, and then because they feel it, it's true, and they don't go the extra step to debunk their emotional myths. That's also true of a lot of other disorders also. They tend to be what I call absolutist, which means it's black and white, absolute, either or reasoning. They don't have a lot of shades of gray. That kind of ties into the concrete stuff and inflexible reasoning. They tend to over-exaggerate or be histrionic about stuff. They, you know, everything is a huge mountain out of a molehill kind of stuff. They also tend to be what I call developmentally fixated. And what I mean by that is whatever age they started really getting into the mindset of using traumas to, substances to use their to solve their problems and to medicate themselves, they sort of get stuck at that age, very much like trauma victims do, which is why I have this notion of substances as trauma, and that's actually being outlined in a book I'm writing about the substances as trauma model and its impact on folks and what to do to get over it. So, preview of coming attractions. They also typically have a poor resiliency, so they're not very resilient. They don't bounce back from stuff really well. They tend to get downed pretty easily, and they don't tend to come back from that easily, and they tend to use drugs or alcohol or whatever to cope with that kind of stuff. The other thing I see is they typically have a lot of self-identity or existential slash spiritual issues involved. So even if they're not traditionally spiritual in the sense of Judeo-Christian type stuff or Buddhist or whatever, they typically have a lot of issues about where their place is and where they fit in, both in a socio-personal status scenario as well as a identity, self-identity, and how do they connect with something bigger than themselves and that sort of thing. So I typically... It's a lot of work with these folks, and I typically, as I said, I typically use a non-traditional, non-12-step, non-biomedical model for these folks, non-disease model. So I typically use a combination of cognitive, behavioral, and cognitive behavioral approaches, which involve rational motive thinking and that sort of thing. For those of you who don't know what that is, that's okay. I'll sum it up and say... kind of as you believe, so shall you do. That's the model. So I try to teach people to think better so that they can reprogram their brain kind of like a computer so they're not giving themselves cognitive errors, thinking errors, computer programming errors. That's kind of the basis of cognitive behavioral management, as well as avoiding environments and people and places and things, kind of like the 12 Steps talk about, which I'm in complete agreement with, that encourage them to use this, because those are all setting events, environmental triggers, and that's particularly true in the first 2 years, because most of the people who are going to relapse are going to do it in the first 2 years. If you can get through the first 2 years, you're probably pretty good to go. And the vast majority of people relapse in the first 6 months. So I will also use what's called reality therapy, which is Glasser's treatment, which talks about what are your goals and what are you doing to accomplish them, or what are you not doing to accomplish them, and what do you have to do to get there, kind of stuff. That's kind of a simplistic overview, but that's kind of the deal. And one of the things I talk about is real goals versus or depth goals or ultimate goals versus superficial seeming surface goals. I'm sorry I can't say that better. I'll give an example. I think folks will get me more when I say this. I will often ask somebody, what was your real goal doing that? And so, for example, somebody will be driving in a car, and I'll use one of my own irrational areas, which is traffic and so-called, quote-unquote, stupid people. That's obviously a cognitive distortion on my part. But, you know, that's one of the battles I have with myself when I drive. And as any of you know who've ridden in this traffic, well, it's certainly not as bad as New York City or maybe even downtown Chicago or L.A. or San Francisco at rush hour. Atlanta's pretty obnoxious. In the vernacular of the Southland, ain't getting no better. I'm a South Carolina guy, so I can make fun of the South, okay? Example would be, let's say I'm trying to get from point A to point B. It's on a Friday. I'm on Highway 400 going north, which is going to be a gridlocked kind of deal. Right. So I should be expecting traffic, right? So if I'm trying to get from point A to point B and I get locked up in a traffic jam or something happens, there's an accident, I'm going to be stuck on the interstate for a while, right? If I start getting really mad and frustrated and all bent out of shape and irrational and histrionic and whatever, you know, I have to stop and ask myself, what's my real goal here? Well, you know, I can say, well, my real goal is to get from point A to point B, you know, more effectively and quicker and, you know. And if that's true, and what is what I'm doing, getting all jacked out of shape, really helping me do that, right? No, it's not. So obviously that needs to go out of the window, and I need to start doing something different that I'm not frustrating myself or pissing myself off. Notice how I said that, because that's really important. We're going to get to that in a later podcast. But the reality is nobody can piss you off. Nobody can make you angry. Nobody can make you happy. We all do it to ourselves. That's the bottom line, by what we tell ourselves about reality that we don't like. Zen philosophy has a credo in there that says what makes people unhappy is that they don't like the reality they get held. They have a different view of reality than the reality is, and they are unhappy about it. That's a common sense version. The Zen philosophers say it a whole lot more eloquently than I ever could, but that's the bottom line. And the cognitive behavioral model kind of has that sort of vibe to it. But at any rate, the point is we choose to tell ourselves angry messages because we get in a habit of doing it. It seems, you know, easy, and we hear it a lot, and so we get in a bad habit of doing it, and then it becomes almost so-called automatic, and then we have to work to unprogram ourselves. So I say to myself, you know, is what you're doing really helping you get there faster? Well, maybe getting from point A to point B quicker, faster, safer, less stressed, yada, yada, isn't my real goal, right? And then, of course, I have to say to myself, well, heck, what is your real goal? Well, maybe my unconscious goal, the goal that I'm not really aware of, but somewhere, you know, to quote one of my favorite horror movie guys, you know, in the deep dark recesses of my unconscious. Gotta love Bela Lugosi, right? And if you guys don't know who that is, shame on you. You need to go look that guy up. He's just a famous classic. He's kind of like Boris Karloff. He's like, well, those guys are just like the awesome classic horror movie guys. Anyway, I digress. You know, if in my unconscious, you know, recesses, I have another goal. And the real goal is to prove how unfair life is and what a victim I am and oh, poor me and yada, yada, yada. Then obviously telling myself things like it's not fair, I can't stand it, I can't deal with it, oh my God, this is awful and terrible, it's the worst thing that could happen, oh poor me, yada yada. Well, yeah, that's going to make me feel like crap and that's going to make me feel like a victim. And yeah, I will have proved my point. Life is unfair and I'm this victim and oh, woe is me, right? So then I have to ask myself, which one of those goals, if I have both of those goals and I'm holding both of those goals simultaneously, right, the goal to be a victim, to prove that life's unfair and I'm this hapless victim, versus getting from one office to the next or getting from my office to home quicker, faster, easier, with less stress, which one of those is my real goal? So I'm sure my folks that I work with are so sick of me saying this, they could just like bop me over the head with a dead fish. But, you know, I'll often say, okay, what's your real goal? And they kind of roll their eyes and look at me. And I'm like, no, come on. What's your real goal here, right? And that's really what we're talking about. Is your real goal to prove how unfair life is? Or is your real goal to get from point A to point B? Because if your real goal is to get to point A to point B, you ain't getting there by bitching and whining and moaning and complaining and feeling sorry for yourself. And I'm speaking to me too, obviously. However, if your real goal is to prove what a victim and how unfair life is, boy, you're going to do that in a heartbeat doing the stuff you're doing. So then you have to say, which one of these goals is really more important to me right now? And in the long run, which one is really more important? Because if my ultimate goal, my long-term goal, is to live longer, happier, you know, less physically disabled, stress-free life, certainly if I hold on to the notion that life, you know, is an unfair, you know, bigot against me and, you know, beats me up and I'm helpless and oh my God, I'm not going to be getting a long life and living healthy and all this kind of stuff. I'm going to be really miserable. So that's what I mean when I say, what, you know, what's your superficial or surface goal, what's your underlying unconscious, unaware goal, and which one is your real goal? And so I often ask addicts that, or anybody I'm working with, right? The other thing I'll do is use concepts that Alfred Adler, another famous guy that I just love, he's the guy we get these natural and logical consequences from, and from whence the so-called tough love parenting comes from Adlerian concepts. And so one of the things that Adler talks about is mastery over yourself and life tasks versus mastery over the environment and other people. And that his notion that the sick person, if you will, the pathological person, the unhealthy person tries to master other people and make life go the way they want it to go, as opposed to mastery over themselves and conquering life tasks that we all get confronted with, right? So I'll talk about, you know, what are you trying to get mastery over, and talk about natural logical consequences, which are the things that happen if nobody intervenes, right? So one of the examples I often use with folks is, okay, if you know, if you don't take a bath, you smell. And if you smell, eventually people aren't going to want to be around you. And so the natural logical consequence of not taking a bath and using deodorant and being clean is you're not going to have any friends. You're not going to have any girlfriends or boyfriends. Nobody's going to be around you. You're going to be walking around with clothespins on their nose going, dude, go, take a bath now. You know. And that's why I tell parents, and that's the biggest thing I have to teach parents, is to get rid of this notion of quote-unquote punishment. And get out of that, because what punishment does is it makes the person being punished the victim and makes you the bad guy or bad gal. And that ain't the reality. The reality is we are all responsible for our own crap. Bottom line, end of story. Right? And the sooner we get used to letting people suffer the natural and logical consequences of their actions, the quicker they're going to learn that they got to change something they're doing if they want to change their outcome. Right? Now, obviously, when we're talking about life or death scenarios, all bets are off. Okay? But barring extreme kinds of circumstances, I tell everybody, let your folks suffer natural and logical consequences. Not a good idea to save people from their stuff, because the only thing you're teaching them is that somebody's going to save them. And you know what? That's not reality. Okay. So sometimes I use creative things to address folks. One of the things I do is use music with what I do. And I modify a lot of stuff that I use based on you know, the person I'm working with. So if I've got somebody who's very concrete, I'm going to have to approach them with a much more concrete approach and give them examples and teach them how to do stuff, as opposed to using a more esoteric, abstract, synthetic reasoning stuff if I'm working with somebody who's got a lot of that. So part of the other reason I do my own testing is I get to see how somebody processes data, which impacts how I do therapy with them, right, and how I coach them and how I help them. I mean, that's just a huge impact, because no two people are the same. You know, we're all different. Even if we have the same disorders, we may have some similarities, but we all do it differently, and that's really important. So as you can see, this thing about treating addictions is very, very complex, because they coexist with a plethora of other pathological conditions that all have to be addressed, because if you don't, you're just going to go from, as Alejandro Marchese in the University of Rome used to say, they go from one addiction to another. He was also a very anti-12-step guy, and I really applauded him for that. And working in the VA at the time, which was a very 12-step disease model-oriented place, which was really brave of him. So the bottom line is, addictions are multifaceted. No two addicts are the same, even though any more than no two conduct disordered people or ADHD people or straight people or gay people or bisexual people or men or women or anything. You know, anytime we start using generalizations, we're in big trouble. Okay, so you got to focus on individual problems, individual skills, and life sets, because that's going to help them. And if you can use their positive stuff to overcome their negative stuff, that's going to be really cool, because everybody, whether they realize it or not, has got some underlying positive potential or set of potentials that you can use to do that, to help them overcome the stuff they're not so good with. And part of the testing also tells me that, right? And I can also identify people who will help them in their journey, and that's part of the reason I work with parents when I'm working with kids, because I want them to empower their kids. Again, you heard me say this in a previous podcast, reclaim your personal power. I don't care whether you're an addictions person or a conduct disorder person or an ADHD person. Take responsibility for your stuff and take your daggum power back, because taking your power back means taking your life back. And I tell everybody on the planet, if you don't take the power back, somebody else is going to take it for you, which means you don't have control over your life. And in my personal opinion, not being in control of your own life kind of stinks. Okay, actually, it sucks big time, in my personal opinion. So I don't want somebody else running my life for me. I don't want somebody else telling me how to do stuff. I want to do it. But you know what? If I'm in control of my life, that means I have complete and total responsibility for stuff I do. So if I screw up, I have to own it. If I get angry, I have to own it. Because if I'm looking at other people to fix my problem, I'm going to grow old and bitter and pissed off and sad and other kinds of negative stuff that ain't cool. The other thing I'll say is, it's really important to look at diet, nutritional stuff. I'm a huge holistic health and wellness freak. And I have a lot of my folks who are actually going the holistic route instead of the medication route and doing extremely well with it. But having said that, in order to do that, you have to be very, very anal about the stuff you eat and don't eat, and it takes a lot of planning and forethought and willpower, which things that certainly ADHD people are not very good at, and addictions folks typically aren't good at in the early stages. But let's face it, anybody can be taught to do it if they really, really want it badly enough, and if they're sick of being sick. And that's really what it boils down to. Are you sick of being sick? Are you sick of the consequences you're getting? You know, because if you are, you got to do something different, right? And you can't wait for God to heal you. You know, you can pray for God's help, and that's a great thing. But you can't sit around on your ass waiting for God to do his job. You got to help him out here, okay? Or Allah or Buddha or the Force or whatever. And you can't wait for your parents or me or anybody else to fix you, because I don't have the power to do that. And that's why I said in an earlier podcast, if people make the choice to get better and do great things with their life, that means they've taken the power. That means they've done that nasty four-letter obscene word, four-letter word, work. Oh, my God. Right? And they deserve all the credit. Period. End of story. I'm simply an overpaid teacher and coach that taught them how to do it. That's it. That was my role. An occasional butt-kicking when they don't do it, and an occasional cheerleading when they do. And that's really the reality. It's a hard road. And I tell people this with everything. Anything worth having is hard work. I don't care if it's learning to be a good father. I don't care if it's learning to be a good parent. I don't care if it's learning to be a good sex partner. I don't care if it's learning to be a good musician or sculptor or rap artist or athlete or whatever. It takes that nasty four-letter word work, which takes personal responsibility, which means you have to be in control and you have to be responsible and you have to grab life and yourself and your crap by the yarbles, so to speak, and not muck around and do it. That's my prep talk and that's my spiel for today. I hope everybody got something out of this. Thanks for listening. I apologize if I was a little long-winded. I have a tendency to be verbose, and that's probably one of my bigger faults, although I've got plenty of them, let me tell you. Thanks a lot, and I hope you guys had a good time listening, and we'll be changing topics on the next podcast. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to tackle, but I've got a whole cornucopia of topics from which to choose. So until then, be well, be healthy, be powerful. Thank you.